Welcome to the Big 60s Sort Out, brought to you by the Big Beatles Sort Out. We've spent three series sorting the Beatles, and now we're turning our attention to the competition, the context, the bigger picture. Who are they up against? What music influenced them? And will we hear the shockwaves of the Beatles' epic success as we sort all the UK number ones from the 1960s by ranking them for music, lyrics and production? Thanks for joining us as we try and sort out the 60s. Welcome to Series 4, Episode 14. I'm Gary Abbott, author, musician and podcaster, and please welcome my popular music history expert brother, Paul.
Hello everyone. Oh, we had a time getting started tonight, didn't we? My computer finally tipped into obsolescence.
Oh dear.
Which is stupid because it's an iMac and it runs absolutely fine for things like Pro Tools and all the stuff that I do on it, all the posh stuff. But I just can't get on two-factor authentication for the thing we used to use. So we've done a workaround. We're still here.
You can still hear us.
Yeah.
But another peek behind the technical curtain there.
Yeah. So if Apple want to send me a brand new iMac, that'd be nice.
Yeah, if you're listening.
Apple podcasts.
To be fair, if anyone wants to send us a brand new iMac, you're more than welcome. And if you do, then the best way to do it would be to keep in touch with us on Twitter and Instagram at big_sort, or email us with your free goodies at bigbeatlessort.
Try that again.
thebigbeatlessortout@gmail.com. And please like, subscribe and review our show if you would be so kind. And consider dropping by our links on the episode. Who knows what might be available? I can't project that far into the future in my mind.
2 weeks.
2 weeks, yes.
2 weeks.
I'm literally waiting for the CDs to come back from the burners, because I'm still in the 90s.
Yeah.
For my next album. So.
Good out.
Yeah. So have we got any news going on? Anything? Any shout outs, Paul? Any?
Anything? Nothing particularly, really, for this past week or so in terms of Beatles world. We've had a bit of an uptick on listeners for the episode that is out the week we're recording this.
Oh, well, that's nice.
So it seems. So if anyone's new, welcome, willkommen, insert hello in your language here. It's great if anyone new finds us, because as I did today in a little infographic on Instagram, we've been doing this for a little while now, so.
Yes, we're in our fourth series, and you put a very handy guide to how to listen to us if you want to catch up. Because I start new podcasts, and I do that thing of listening to the latest episode, and then if I like it, going right back to the beginning.
Which can be a strange thing.
Which can be strange, because then you have to work your way back up. And I think with anyone listening to this, if you think of doing that, obviously, you have to bear in mind that it takes us a few episodes to settle in, but we have been pretty consistent, for four years.
Even when we're not forced to stay in the house because of disease.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we carried on. It wasn't just a fad like that disease.
Yeah. We hope.
I suppose then we should get straight on with it, because we've got a bit of a bumper one this week. As you know, we kind of sometimes are four songs, sometimes are five. This is a five song week. And as no matter what we do, we seem to talk for about an hour and 20 minutes anyway. We better move on with it. So, excitingly, we are in the year 1963.
This is exciting.
This is the first episode for 1963. And there's some interesting little things go on this year, I'm sure.
Yes, yes.
And what were Dem Dare Beatles doing around this time then, Paul?
Well, let me just start with a little bit of a 1963 welcome, though, before we get going.
Okay.
Just because I was doing some research, I found the cover of the Daily Mirror on the 1st of January 1963.
Right.
And it says, "Welcome to," and then in brackets, "the year of hope that took a darned long time a-coming," close brackets, 1963, right. "And a salute to Mirror's Man of the Year." You could guess who the Man of the Year in 1963 is going to be.
A clue as to the manner of the man.
Politician.
Oh, no, I'm not going to even try and embarrass
very, very
myself.
Famous politician.
No.
Not British.
Not British?
No.
Oh, do you mean JFK?
Yes, it's JFK.
Yeah.
So the front cover is John F. Kennedy tipping back in a chair. He'll hurt himself doing that. Mirror's Man of the Year Our choice is President John Fitzgerald Kennedy, aged 45. That's how old I am. Of the United States. And, yeah, so that's a strangely, you know, looking back to think of how his 1963 turned out. Mm. And the significance of that. It was really interesting to come across that front page of a 1st of January 1963 thing. Mm. But I also found a couple of things as well. I think this was possibly in the same... Yeah, it was in the same issue of the Mirror. Tax slashed on radios, TV, discs. So I think this is probably significant in the sense that... So the Chancellor of the Exchequer in 1963 was Reginald Maudling. And one of the things he did was he slashed a load of tax.
Right.
And he's done it on TV sets, transistor radios and discs and cosmetics. So these are all things that interest young people.
Yeah.
The people who are going out and buying records. The people who were into pop stars. So discs at 6 shillings 11 pence cut to 6 shillings 3 pence. A £2 long player will drop by 4 shillings and a 34 shillings 5 pence LP will be 31 shillings. So these are cuts making it more music more accessible to people.
They're bolstering the industry, aren't they, though? They're stimulating the industry a bit as far as...
And, you know, this point in the 60s, we're about to see this huge, I don't want to say revolution, but this huge upturn in sort of youth culture and the power of pop, you know, and entertainment. And it probably helped by things like people being able to afford a TV set a bit better or a radio or even like the cosmetics and stuff like that, you know, part of that, all of that lifestyle stuff. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
And the only other thing I want to mention from the 1963 Mirror is Beeching hits storm over jam tarts. So Richard Beeching, the Dr. Beeching, the guy who slashed all the railways in Britain.
Yes, same man.
Yeah, he's featured here in this tiny article because a Labour MP, Victor Yates, wrote to him saying that the price of tarts, sandwiches and cakes at Birmingham Snow Hill Station was too expensive. Twas ever thus, Victor Yates.
So did he just go and close down the station then?
Probably.
Well, I'll just close it down then. How does that suit you?
His letter stated, custard tarts are charged at 8 pence each and jam tarts at 5 pence. Prices far in excess of those outside. So there you go. I ended up going down such a rabbit hole looking up Hansard to find the parliamentary information about how that was responded to. But that is beyond our remit.
Slightly, just ever so slightly lateral.
Anyway.
So that's the year. And what about the lads?
Okay, so 2nd of January, Beatles are due to go up to Scotland for a few dates for a sort of proper tour as the Beatles in Scotland. Mm. But start of 1963 is terrible, terrible weather. And Scotland's pretty bad in winter anyway.
Mm.
So their plane gets diverted to Aberdeen. Poor Neil Aspinall's driven the van up in horrible weather to Edinburgh to meet them, and they're not there.
Oh.
So their tour, they have a little tour of Scotland in Elgin, Dingwall, Bridge of Allen and Aberdeen. And then it's a case of all these live dates. And this is what 1963 is going to be. It's going to be all these live dates, which are, like we've said before, sort of starting to expand out a bit further from the northwest each time we sort of look at them. So like they're going down to Chatham on the day after Please Please Me comes out, the single.
Yeah.
So obviously they're all over the place. They're still playing the Cavern quite a lot and come back to Liverpool here and there, but not as often. You know, there's no big blocks of like 10 days at the Cavern anymore, stuff like that. But they're doing more live appearances on TV. So the faces are getting out there. Like they're on Thank Your Lucky Stars, which is, and they're doing a day of BBC radio recordings. And obviously we know that we're getting, this is the point where the live at the BBC stuff starts to get generated.
Mm.
Loads of stuff in the Midlands. And then when we get to the 2nd of February, that's when they do their first bit of the tour with Helen Shapiro.
Ah, right.
So we've talked about before, and Arthur Howes, the promoter. So they're with her in Bradford, Doncaster, Bedford, Wakefield, Carlisle and Sunderland. Then they have a day on the 11th of February 1963 to go and record Please Please Me, the album.
Yeah, just the whole album, yeah.
Yeah, all the stuff that they haven't done so far anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Then they have a few more dates that aren't with the Helen Shapiro tour. They have one of these days where, like, they've got a gig in Doncaster. But they're down in London in the morning to shoot the album cover and then go on the BBC radio at lunchtime, then go to Doncaster. And they're doing this sort of thing almost like every day or every other day. They've got this mad cycle of back to London, back to Liverpool, back to... like that. It must have been absolutely dizzying.
Well, this is the ramp up to them.
Oh, yeah.
Because they've had a song out, but it, you know, hasn't worried the top 10, but it's done all right, hasn't it? So this
but
is the...
Please Please Me is there now, because on the 23rd of February, Please Please Me gets to number one in all charts, except the one we're doing.
Right, okay. So, right... So they are exploding, but we're not going to talk about it.
No. Okay. But that happens while they're on the second bit of the Helen Shapiro tour, which is at the end of February. And that's also where they're writing From Me to You, which is obviously going to be their next single, which we may end up talking
about. This week.
They end the Helen Shapiro tour in Hanley.
I was just about to say, didn't they end up in Stoke? Because our mum shared a photo of... The Beatles and Shapiro standing around somewhere that looked suspiciously like Hanley.
Yeah, they ended at the Gaumont Theatre in Hanley.
The Gaumont? I wonder where that is.
Oh, I think, did I look it up? I can't remember. Gaumont was one of these chains, and lots of places had the name Gaumont, and then things changed and different companies bought them out and stuff like that. But 5th of March 1963, they go and record From Me to You and Thank You Girl. Do a Photoshop, do an interview with Boyfriend magazine, then drive back to Liverpool.
Now, did you just say a Photoshop by accident, or is that...
I don't know, a photo shirt, a photo shirt.
It's all right, I was just checking.
A photo shirt.
Yeah,
a photo shoot.
A photo shoot, okay.
Yeah, let's say go back to Liverpool, a couple more dates, and I'm going to stop there because there's a sort of line there before they start touring with someone else. Or a couple of other people from the 9th of March, which takes us about to where we're going to end this episode.
Right.
So, you know, they've had their first number one by most measures, except the ruler we're using for
except
it.
Except the one, except ours.
Yeah.
And not just ours, because that's why it doesn't appear on number one, the number one album, isn't it?
Yeah, well, of the chart that has been retrospectively made into the official UK number ones chart. But it is mad. They're number one in basically everything else.
Yes. Yeah. So they are. They're not just ramping up. They're actually... They've kind of been fired out the cannon now a bit. They're actually... They're on the way, aren't they? So, well, they've passed the post. I don't know. I can't find the right metaphor. They're going. The Beatles are out there.
They're proper going, aren't they?
Proper going. But not for us, because we're doing the other chart. So what were people listening to other than the Beatles... that they really liked as well. That was a smooth link, wasn't it?
Oh, professional.
So, well, let's find out, because it's very interesting that this is... I mean, some of these were... So when did Please Please Me come out again? Just remind me.
Please Please Me was released on the 11th of January 1963.
So actually, all of these are contemporary with it. None of them predate it. They're all happening at the same time as that's climbing up an alternative chart. Okay, then. So, yeah, let's see what people were listening to. Shall we go for the first one?
Go for it.
Well, first up, we have Cliff Richard and the Shadows, The Next Time.
They say I'll love again someday, a true love will come my way the next time. But after you, there'll never be a next time.
The next time, Paul.
Oh, the next time we might get away with not listening to Cliff. I'm starting to get Elvis syndromes from Cliff. And this episode is not going to help with that.
No.
I think we need to be clear up front now. Everyone in this episode, all five songs, we have heard from one way or another.
Yes.
These people.
Nothing new here.
No.
Apart from the songs.
This is Cliff Richard and the Shadows with The Next Time, which becomes number one on the 3rd of January 1963. He spends 3 weeks at number one, but it's a double A.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to go into double A sides because we've mentioned a couple that we've been calling double A's. There's no such official thing at this point as a double A. It's just records where both sides are promoted the same rather than them saying this is a double A. So The Next Time is the A side. The next song we're talking about is the B-side, but they both counted at number one. It's mad.
Yes.
Anyway, it's Cliff, so it's produced for Columbia Records by Norry Paramore. This song's written by Buddy Kay and Philip Springer, who are sort of songwriters with really sort of an amazing pedigree. So this is from the film Summer Holiday, 1963's Not Summer Holiday, which is a big smash film for Cliff. But Buddy Kay and Philip Springer are the people who wrote... Well, Springer co-wrote Santa Baby.
Oh, that's bizarre to think someone wrote that.
Yeah, I know. It just seems to have always been there, doesn't it? Yeah. With Eartha Kitt purring it into your ear. And Buddy Kay co-wrote You're Adorable by Perry... You're Adorable.
Hey!
Yeah. B, you're arboreal. C, yes, you live in a tree. C. That's what I sing to myself. And they both wrote together a song I really, really love, which is Sweet William, done by Millie Small, who did My Boy Lollipop.
Okay.
And if you've never heard Sweet William by Millie, it's fab, absolutely fab. Mm. Anyway, that's the songwriters for this. And this is from the soundtrack to Summer Holiday. And I'm not going to talk about the film because the song Summer Holiday is going to crop up at some point.
So save it for that.
Save it for then. But I think, yeah, it's interesting. Cliff didn't have any number ones in 1961. And he only had one in 1962. I mean, he had some number twos, threes, fours. You know, it's not like he wasn't doing very well.
We only had one of him last year, and then it 1960 when we last had a cup? Because he had a few.
We've had the Shadows, obviously.
Yes,
Cliff has had a sort of... It's not like he's on the back burner. If you're regularly getting it in at number two or three or four...
Yeah, you're staying in the...
You're doing all right.
Aren't you?
But it's interesting, anyway, that there's sort of been this big gap where the Shadows have seemed comparatively dominant, but we'll get to them.
Is it? I know you don't want to talk about the film, but is it also? Is this the point where he's starting his kind of Elvis film career style thing, or is he?
Well, he's done a few films, but I think this is the real symbolic one of like, oh, that's a Cliff movie, you know?
Right. Okay.
That's a big, colourful, family-friendly, song fest type thing.
Okay then. Okay. Well, so I mean. This is a very slow song.
It is a very slow song.
And yet, a slow song. Yeah. And yet, at only 3 minutes long, you think, well, it's so slow and it's only 3 minutes, it must be done. And then it's like, no, there's still another verse to go. It feels like 10 minutes of, to my ears, seemingly random chord changes.
Yeah, it doesn't do much for me, I've got to be honest. Yeah. Sorry, Cliff fans.
It's a shame when you hear the pedigree of the writers, because you think, well... And there's bits that sound a little like something else that you think's better from somewhere, but not quite enough to make the song good. There's bits where you think, that sounds like, and I shouldn't put my finger on it. And then I realise parts of it sound like Starting Over, which obviously would be the other way around.
Yes, I got that as well. And it's because it's got that 12-8 feel.
Yeah.
So
Yeah, and that kind of ascending phrase. But obviously that comes later, so maybe John ripped this off. You never know. If he did, he ripped it off and massively improved it. It just seemed to plod onwards through sections and even either a key change or a strange bridge that are all instantly forgettable. I'm literally forgetting it as I'm listening to it and then wondering why I'm sat here and who I am. It's kind of not just forgetting the song, it's making me forget existence.
Oh wow,
the band are okay.
Yeah,
you know, it's so the Shadows,
but it's the Shadows with Norry Paramore playing the organ alongside them and the Norry Paramore strings as an overdub. Yes. Later and that awful sounding piano, and it's just but it could be anyone. It didn't have to be the Shadows, it could be anyone.
There's
no Shadows identity to it.
No, they are just session musicians. It's not a Shadows record that with Cliff on it. This like this sometimes sounds like. I was going to ask if it was a piano. I quite like the chimey piano sound on this, but never mind. Cling Richard. I was going to say Cliff sings. I said Cling sifts.
See, he's destroyed us with the next time.
No, Cliff sings. He sings it perfectly, but unfortunately for a boring song, perfect really isn't doing anything for it because it just makes it all very, you know, so what. Yeah, there's some strings that come in for the second time round. The yawn about, they don't really help. It's just not very interesting a song. It goes to places that doesn't seem to resolve right, and I just don't like it. I can't imagine this with the lead of the two. I've given it 33 for music.
Right, fair enough. I mean, I've got not much to say about it. Like I say, it's very slow. It's got that 12/8 feel. It modulates literally up a half step from G to G sharp towards at the end to try and make it seem like it's going somewhere.
And it doesn't.
But it doesn't.
Yes, it did have a key change, as I thought. And
you were right.
But it is
you
a kind right. of a so what kind of key change. Like, and
we will have an example later with a different song of in this episode change. Of a better key change.
Yes.
It's exactly the same musical step, but does it much better.
Yes, so production then, I mean, nothing. So I quite like the chimey piano sound. You obviously don't, from the sound of it.
You said
the word awful sound of piano.
Yeah, I don't like the piano sound at all. It's, everything feels very woozy. Like the organ's got that strange sort of, like a slow rotary speaker feel to it that makes everything like a bit, like you're sort of spiralling down. Like someone's put something in your drink. And it's like, what's the big sleep or something?
Yeah.
And the piano, I think it's a piano and a celeste, you know, the little bell piano.
That's what's
keyboard.
Making the chimey sound.
Yeah, it combined, but it's not for me.
Oh, I didn't mind that. I mean, I don't mind the strings. I've got a massive problem with the production. I quite like that at some point, well, I don't know really if I like it, but at some point Cliff goes boo-whip at some point. Do you notice that? It's just one line when he sings it, and I think he's saying "but with," and he goes "buwit." Listen out for that anyway. Yeah, I can't really fault. I've given it 49 for production. I don't think that's where its problem lies so much.
It was recorded on the 10th of May 1962 and on the 19th of November 1962 for the overdubs. I discovered a website that has insanely detailed Cliff Richard song recording details, which is. Both fascinating and terrifying in equal measure. It's, but I'm glad it's there because I like to be able to look into these things.
Yes, a good resource.
But it's Abbey Road, it's Norrie Paramore, we sort of expect a certain standard, so there you go.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, lyrics, they're not going to add much to it either. I mean, the words are about as interesting as the song. I don't really have much to say about them. It's all about the imagined next time, but you can't shake the pain of the last time. And that's that, really, isn't it?
Yep.
You know, no, it's not. It's all just that. It's just that cheese, really. I've given it 39 for lyrics, 40 overall.
The only thing I can think of with the lyrics, I've just noticed while I'm looking at it. In the film, he sings this whilst wandering around Greece, in Athens, in fact.
Yes.
And he's looking at the Parthenon at the distance. And there's a line, "We'll just be ancient history." And I wonder if it was written to order, whether they said, well, this is going to be a film. It's going to be in this scene. But it might not be that clever.
It would be funny if they wrote that line and then they built the entire trip to the entire film around that line of the song.
Yeah.
They thought, well, that's it. We'll have him in Athens because of that line. Yeah, it's got that line in it. 39 for lyrics, 40 overall. It's really not one that kind of comes thumping out of the kind of a out of the traps to get us going, is it? This one?
No, not really. Like, it doesn't suggest that 1963 is going to be a particularly dynamic year.
If anything, it to me feels like, you know, it really sets the scene of what people. I'm starting to feel the desperation of the people in the 60s for some big breakout act to shake things up a bit. You know what I mean?
Well,
I'm starting to feel that. I understand why.
I think you're projecting, but
yes, I am.
I'm sure you're not entirely wrong.
So,
flip over the disc, Gary.
Flip the disc. It got 40 overall. Let's flip the disc. And we've got Cliff Richard in the Shadows with Bachelor Boy.
When I was 16, I fell in love with a girl as sweet as can be. But I remember just in time what my daddy said to me. He said, son, you are a bachelor boy, and that's the way
bachelor boy, Paul?
No, I am not. I am a grown man who's been in a relationship for quite some time. So, yeah, stick well, that in your pipe.
Done.
Yeah, bachelor boy, it's one of these phrases that sort of stuck to Cliff, really, like Peter Pan of pop, that he had a big hit with Bachelor Boy and has remained essentially a confirmed bachelor his entire life.
Yeah.
This is part of his legend. But anyway, compared to The Next Time, this is an absolute banger.
yeah, compared to that, yeah.
So obviously the information's the same, and it's obviously, again, Norrie Paramore, and it's The Shadows, it's Columbia. But the composers of this one, interestingly, are Bruce Welch of The Shadows and Cliff Richard.
Right.
And if you were reading Disc magazine on the 5th of December 1962, there was a letter from Yvonne Stringle, which is a great name, from Abbotsley, 25 Hillside Gardens, Betchworth, Surrey. I have all Cliff Richard's single releases from Move It to his latest, The Next Time. All 38 sides are good, but one is excellent, Bachelor Boy. It is really good to hear Cliff sing this type of number, so different from the others that he has made, says Yvonne. Oh. So,
well, there we go, Yvonne. Yvonne, you've done my job for me.
Yes.
It's many, many years before it needed doing. Right, did she say what the score was for music?
Well, he says Yvonne Stringle, Abbotsley, 25, Hillside Gardens. Maybe that 25 is her score.
Oh.
Yeah. maybe your system only goes up to 25. Anyway, what's really interesting about this song, I think, is that it was written to order, and obviously, like I say, Cliff's name as a songwriter isn't on many songs. But Bruce Welch apparently said it was written to order several weeks after the movie had been completed.
Okay.
And the crew and cast disbanded. It was being edited at Elstree. The producer finds out the film's too short. So right. The easiest way to fix this problem, cheapest way to do it as well, is to get another song.
2 minutes and 7 seconds too short. That's, that's a very fine line.
Well, no, there's they build a little sequence around it.
Oh, okay. There's a bit, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And do they go and do that in the studio then, or do they fly back to Athens? Or wherever
well,
they
it doesn't
were.
All take place in Athens.
No, I've never seen it, so.
Well, I know what you feel about musicals, and I won't make you watch that one.
I'm kind of intrigued, but anyway.
The producers contact Norrie Paramore and say, Norrie, we need another song. He rings up The Shadows. So Bruce Welch picks up the phone and says, hello, Bruce Welch of The Shadows here. And, you know, whatever. Cliff and I were there. A frantic phone call came through from the producer. We started work immediately. The song was completed in less than 2 hours.
Right.
And then they go into Elstree and there's a sequence built around it on a single static set. And it's much nicer to hear the song than see that sequence because it is really cringy.
Right.
Oh,
yes.
There's a bit where someone pretends to inflate Hank Marvin, who is pretending to be a child, kneeling at the feet of Cliff.
What?
Oh. Before they do a weird country dance together.
Right. Oh. I see. I've got the video up, but I'm not going to distract myself by watching.
No.
But I'm now going to make a mental note. I mean, like you say, though, it's already better by the first two bars. You kind of straight away you go, well, this is more interesting. It's quicker for a start. It's quirkier. Yeah. This is compared to the other side, obviously. A bit of country folk.
Yeah, it is really. Do you know what it reminded me of? Because it's sort of in 6/8 time. I'm in one of my tempos and keys things today. It's in D as well, if you're interested. So it goes... Mouse lived in a windmill in old Amsterdam. Except that doesn't come out until 1965, so that's probably influenced by this.
Again, so that's two songs now we've had. Starting
our references are all in the wrong place.
Yeah. Yes, it's quirky. It's got some interesting piano, again. It's got
played
a sing-along...
Played by Hank?
Yeah. By Hank, did he say?
Yeah.
It's got a sing-along chorus, which is better than the last one, which didn't really have anything that you could sing.
I like
to.
The harmonies in this. I
the harmonies are good. Yeah, some harmonies. You know, they remind me quite a lot of some of McCartney's quirkier solo stuff.
Oh.
The harmonies in this. When McCartney wants to go a bit rural with his music.
Which he does occasionally, yeah.
Yeah, I sit around, that kind of thing. There's got I got a little hint of that. It's still not really amazing.
No.
I wouldn't have bought it for this or the other side. So But of the two, I can slightly understand this one more. It's hard to believe still as a combo they topped the chart. It is almost like the world needed a big rock and roll kick up the bottom. The piano's doing a lot of heavy lifting in both these songs, but the Shadows are backing up nicely, as they should. They've got a bit more to do in this one.
Yeah, and also because of the quick time scale, Norrie hasn't done anything mad with a load of strings on top of it.
No. I feel like the outro is very Beatly, don't you?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
It kind of does a big kind of a vocal. The vocal kind of harmony stays whilst the chords move around and then resolves in a very Beatly way. But he did it first again. Maybe we're just going to find out that basically everyone just ripped off Cliff.
Yeah.
But I don't think so. But it's a big omers. Don't get me wrong. I still don't rate it. It sounds like wannabe movie Elvis. Because you think about things like Wooden Heart and all that.
Yes.
And then not long after, you've got Cliff, you know, prancing around singing kind of folky song, you know, after a big ballady thing. It all feels very, you know, well,
how it's can in the mold. It's in the mold.
Yeah. It's a weird thing to want to be anyway, you know, a wannabe Elvis movie, given how they were going. I've given this one 36 for music, which is slightly more generous than the last one. So
did you just say that's a big omers?
A big omers, yeah.
So if you didn't go to East Dayton Primary School in the 1980s, omers is just like saying, ah.
I don't think we're the only people who said omers. I think
no. There'll be lots of people listening to this who don't know that omers is something that we had in primary school.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose so.
I bet no other Beatles podcast has said omers.
Well, that's what they've been getting wrong. That's why we're getting all our new listeners. They come for the colloquialisms.
Yeah.
Production. I'm going to give it just a little bit more than the other side. It doesn't have strings, like you said, but it does have more harmonies, and I like them. And the interplay with the piano and the rest of the band and the voices is quite fun here. This is a good example of something that I think turned out better for its shorter time scale.
Yeah.
I think. It sounds quite nice. So I've given it 51 for production. I'm not, you know.
So like I was saying about it being recorded late, it's like it was recorded on November the 16th, 1962, when all the work for the soundtrack had been done way back before summer, I think.
Yeah.
So that was it. I did, and this is one of the ones where I was looking at the recording analysis and the level of detail about the takes and what version is. Because it's also a good example. This is a good example how whatever we listen to, and the reason I've not been so strict about what version, what mix we're listening to this time round, is because this, for example, is made up of take 10 and 11. Now, something being labelled as a take does not necessarily mean a complete run-through with a band.
No.
But he does two replacement lead vocals on take 10 and 11, which become the UK stereo and mono mixes. The mono is just a fold down of the stereo. Then there's a thing called take 12, but that's actually a remix of an earlier take, which is redone in March 1963 because the US market has a different type of stereo and doesn't want the one that we've got in the UK.
Right.
And then that becomes the de facto version on all the compilations afterwards. So it's a good example, and that thank you, that website, cliffrichardsongs.com, for this level of information into all the different versions that you may have come across. If you've been listening to this since 1963, you may have heard actually four or five different ones, let alone the one in the film being different to the one that was on the single, which is slightly different to the one on the album or America or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, so it's just, weird.
Yeah, it's much more of an industry back then, like, I think, doesn't it, then, because of the differences in... Well, you get radio edits and things now, but most things are kind of compressed for everything, aren't they? You know, you get the same version on most things. But anyway, well, there we go. That's a lot of detail on this song.
This rather slight song.
Yeah, let's go on to the lyrics of it. I mean, the thing that gets me with these lyrics is it makes no sense.
Yeah, I came to that conclusion.
Yeah. Well, let's summarise. His dad tells him to be a bachelor boy his whole life. We don't exactly know why he does that, but he does. He then meets a girl, but presumably doesn't do anything with her because he remembers he has to be a bachelor boy his whole life. So, fair enough, consistent to this point. But then he imagines he probably will meet a girl in the future and have a family and at some point with a child. But until then, he will be a bachelor boy his whole life until his dying day.
Which doesn't make any sense.
Until his dying day.
You can't be a bachelor boy the rest of your life until the point where you're not a bachelor boy.
No.
It just doesn't work.
There is a solution. Clifford. He could be doing both by planning to marry and have a child literally on his dying day.
Oh, yeah.
So on his last day, he could go, you know, go to the wedding, get married, do the thing that people do sometimes after they get married, and then that, and then you know, and that's that. You know. So
he's still got time. Still got time.
Oh yeah, he has, hasn't he? Actually, yeah. We just haven't seen this song conclude yet because Cliff's still going and still a bachelor boy. And like you say, this does have some. I don't know enough. All I know is that he's always been weirdly single in the sense that it's been a thing of. Of his, hasn't it? To
yes, and led to massive speculation over his sort of sexuality and stuff like that, or, which is really no one's business.
It isn't anyone's
except
business,
for the fact that, of course, he was sold very much as, you know, an accessible sort of icon, an idol, you know, for girls to swoon over, and he does all these things, and he's, you know, so. But actually, the reality is, it doesn't matter at all.
It's very strange for him because I mean he's not very old at this point, is he? He's only a young man.
Not in 1963, no.
And to really have nailed his colours to the mast at such a young age to go, yep, I'm going to be bachelor all my life, and to really have meant it from the look of it, at least he's owning the song. You know.
Yeah, yeah. Although my favourite bit of this song is when he says the line, "What my daddy said to me," and for some reason he suddenly does a weird American twang. He goes, "What my daddy said to me."
Is it better than "whip" like he did in the last song?
When he was being a robot.
He does. You do know. You did hear the "whip" bit, didn't you?
Stop talking about "whip."
Okay, I've given it 40 for lyrics, which gives it 42 overall. So, Paul.
Let's move on to something completely different.
I've had enough of Cliff Richard in the Shadows. So, like I say, let's move on to something else. So next we have The Shadows. Dance on. Dance on, Paul. Dance on, Paul.
Don't dance on me. I've got quite big feet, so they're an easy target. Yeah, it's The Shadows with Dance On, which isn't from a film and is not off the album there. Standalone Shadows thing. The Shadows at this point, by the way, are Hank Marvin on lead guitar, Bruce Welch on acoustic guitar, or rhythm guitar, Brian Locking on bass, and Brian Bennett on drums.
Okay.
And I mentioned that simply because of what we're going to talk about after this one. Dance right. On becomes number one on the 24th of January 1963. Gets 1 week at number one.
Okay.
It's obviously Norrie Paramore and Columbia again. And it's written by Valerie and Elaine Murta and Ray Adams, who were a vocal group called the Avons.
Right.
So, which is funny because this is an instrumental.
Guitar instrumental.
But there were vocal versions of this recorded. So Kathy Kirby had a number 11 hit with it in September 1963.
Just singing like... Da, 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 da. Or did it have words?
It had words. But not in the Shadows version, obviously. But yeah, so the Avons, they'd had the UK hit covering Seven Little Girls Sitting in the Back Seat, which is a kind of a sort of novelty doo-wop rock and roll thing.
Kissing and a Cuddling with Fred.
Yeah, that's the one.
Kissing and a Cuddling with Fred. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, they're about trying to distract a driver.
Yeah. It's always a good thing for a song.
Yeah. Or a driver trying to be distracted.
No, a driver they're telling him not to be distracted.
Yeah.
Keep your
because
hands
seven
on the,
people are kissing one man.
Keep your eyes on the road and your hands on the wheel. And keep your beady eyes on the road ahead or something like that. Yeah.
It's something weird, like Snoopy eyes or something.
Snoopy
like that.
Eyes on the, yeah. Anyway.
It's a song with the word carburetor in it anyway. I think. Something like that. Anyway, that's the people who had the UK hit with that, is the Avons who wrote this song.
Right.
The B-side is called All Day, which is a Welch Marvin tune, which is a sort of, they play on bouzoukis in that one. Which makes me wonder whether they were thinking this was going to be something for a film that ends in Greece.
Okay.
But it's not. It's on this. Which is actually quite good. Quite like it. And I think it's a bit more of a bop than this A-side, Dance On. Now, I have sounded like I've been down on The Shadows, but I actually really like The Shadows for the most part.
Yeah.
Except that when I come to do close listening, they're never quite as twangy and aggressive as I have got them in my mind.
Yeah, they're twangy, but not aggressive.
Well, yeah, yeah. And this is another example where, if you'd asked me what the tempo of this was, I would have said it was much faster, but it's not.
No.
So it doesn't make me want to dance.
I take it you knew about this song then before I was doing it.
I have heard it before, yeah.
So I don't think this is one where I don't... If I have heard it, I couldn't differentiate it from any other Shadows thing that isn't Apache. And I like how this is called Dance On, yet the intro has some of the most kind of slightly kind of complex but awkwardy kind of rhythm that we've had in the Shadows songs to date.
Hmm.
It has that kind of like... kind of, you know what I mean? It has a real... It has really strange kind of timing that if you were dancing, would be making a jerk all over the place. You'd be weird. Yeah, it would take some doing. It does settle down, though, from that interesting... Because when the intro started, I thought, this is a bit weird, a bit strange timing, a bit interesting. And then it just settles down into a gentle, slightly underwhelming boppy music, I suppose. The acoustic guitar is strumming double time and it's doing a bit kind of funky, kind of like chopping, and the bass is doing its walking lines and the drums are going all out on the hi-hats, but it just feels like lift music to me, this one. There's a fine line with the Shadows stuff.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I think, imagine them seeing them live playing this, you'd probably be like, yeah, that's really, really cool, but
yeah, and the
for
record,
me, this recording is a bit meh.
Yeah, I mean, the most interesting bit to me is the weird timing on the intro, which comes back in here and there on the bridge and in the outro.
Yeah, it's when he's doing his low, twangy, low strings on the guitar stuff, isn't he?
And they're doing an offbeat kind of weird, or I don't know if they'd even do... It might be one of those things where it sounds more complicated than it is. It sounds like they're doing a bar with a beat missing on purpose, you know, a bit of a stilted...
I don't think they are, but I know what you mean.
Yeah, they've done something, they've worked something out that isn't just strict, you know, 4/4-y type of stuff, but I don't know why this made it. I wonder if they went to pick up the cliff. They didn't, you know, just buy people went to buy the Cliff Richard song, and then they just picked this one up, and there's like, I saw the Shadows. I didn't check to see if I said Cliff Richard and at the top. Yeah, I've given this one 35 for music.
If anyone wants to know, it's in 4/4 and it's in the key of A.
Okay. Is that just to...
That's just because I've written it down this week, because I was thinking about something.
Well, there we go. Production then. I like how clear the acoustic is in this. There's a really nice acoustic sound. I'm getting very used to Hank's distant reverb guitar stick by this point. You know, it's kind of like, yes, Hank.
Well, I mean, it's a defining sound,
sound
of the early
it?
60s.
Yeah.
Completely. Which is why it's always weird when you see Beatles things where they've got no access to the copyright music, so they put in, you know, early 60s music number 39.
Yeah,
and it's always and it always sounds like The Shadows.
That's the thing with this record. It sounds like none of those things to me.
Yeah.
It sounds like we need some quick instrumental music, boys, to not library, kind of royalty-free library music. It's just also clean. You know, what do you think they would have done if someone had given them a rat pedal, Paul? Do you think he would have just stepped on it and just gone like, yeah.
And I think the thing is, if you listen to the stereo mix of this, which I put on our little playlist, it's good for listening to all the individual parts of it, but you've got like the drums in the left and the bass. Both of the guitars are in the right, and all of the rest of the space, the center area of the stereo field, is just the reverb off Hank's guitar.
Off his guitar, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It does. Well, I don't know if I like the fact that they always sound like... I can never make my mind up. They always sound like the clean channel kind of record of a band pre any effects, you know. You know, nowadays, especially, you record everything clean. often so that you can play around. You don't always have to do that, but you know, you might record everything clean so you can then add your effects on and try different things.
Yeah, or use like amp simulators and things like
that. But and the shadows just sound like that. They sound like keep everything's on the clean channel, and it does mean everything's very, very clear and easy to listen to, which is, you know, in line with what their genre is. But I don't know. But you can't fault that you can hear everything, and it sounds quite clear, crystal. So I've given it 52 for production, which gives it 44 overall because there's no lyrics.
No, there are no lyrics.
So it does quite well out of that, almost like they knew.
Hmm.
Anyway, Paul, have you got anything else to say about that one?
No, nothing except that, of course, the shadows, I mean, they are massively dominant at this point.
Yeah.
If it's not just themselves on their own, they're with Cliff. They are a huge force in British music.
Yes.
You know, what could possibly break their hold on the British charts? We just don't know.
Who knows? And next, Paul, could we please have something that isn't Cliff and or the shadows or something that sounds like it or has anything to do with them? Could we please?
I'll do my best.
All right. So next up we have Jet Harris and Tony Meehan, Diamonds. Diamonds, Paul?
Diamonds are from some people who used to be in the shadows. yeah, guess what? It's some ex-shadows getting together to do a tune written by the guy who wrote the shadows' most famous tune.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With
so,
the big reverby guitar is the main thing.
Yeah. So, this is Diamonds. It spends 3 weeks at number one from the 31st of January 1963. Tony Meehan produces it. We've talked about Tony Meehan as a producer for Decca before.
Right.
You know, being involved with the Beatles sort of time at trying to get onto Decca. Like I say, it's written by Jerry Lorden, who wrote Apache. The B-side is a song called Foot Stomp, and it is a song.
Right.
And it's really plodding. It's a kind of Mickey take about hearing the same rock and roll song everywhere you go. But it just slows down in the choruses, so where it should be sort of fun and like funny, it falls a bit flat. But okay. This side I like.
This side, yes.
Yeah, and the reason I like it is probably because, and it's, we've just been listening to three Abbey Road productions with Norrie Paramore of Cliff and the Shadows or the Shadows. We're suddenly at a different studio, and it's really clear we're at a different studio. And there's a different energy and there's a different feel to it. Even if it's less hi-fi, I think it's got something else about it.
Yeah. I don't wonder how much of that's the song. Well, we'll talk about it, shall we? As is our remit. Because it's not terribly unlike The Shadows, but at the same time, it's quite different-ish to The Shadows, isn't it? It's obviously in the mould of The Shadows, quite literally. But there's a different vibe. I think this is definitely the better song I've compared to Dance On.
Yeah.
The melody and feel is just miles more interesting and better. We get a drum solo.
You don't get many long drum solos in number one hits.
And is that because, is it Tony, which one is it? Who's the Shadows guy?
So Jet Harris is the lead guitarist on this. So he was the bassist in The Shadows between 59 and 62.
Right.
And here he's playing this Fender Jaguar.
Mm.
And he's tuned. It's tuned down. So the low string at least is tuned down to a low D. So it's got an extra bit of twang. He used to play Fender 6 quite a lot to get a twangy sound. And then on drums, you've got Tony Meehan, who was in The Shadows from 59 to 61. And so you've got that. It's basically the Shadows rhythm section.
Yeah.
The old Shadows rhythm section. But do you know who else is playing on it? We've got Glenn and Chris Hughes on the saxophones and piano. But you've got Jimmy Page on acoustic rhythm guitar and John Paul Jones on bass, who, of course, are, at this point, very young session men who go on to be the heart of Led Zeppelin in the 70s.
Maybe that's that bit of edge that we're hearing in this. Definitely feels like, I mean, I don't want to get into anything to do with why the Shadows got through so many members and they split off and made their own number. I'm sure there's a load of interesting stories about that, or maybe not. But it does. You're literally hearing the branching of a band into something else with different people's influence, aren't you, in a different studio?
Yeah.
But like that, because he's a feature name on it, the drummer gets his own feature in it, which is cool.
And it's a really good drum solo.
It is very good. All the way through, the drums are good and made a feature of. It's got some great mood and atmosphere. It's not as crystal clear as the one we've just been listening to, but the low backing vocals that come in here, very low, and the little touches here and there of kind of the glissando chords and the little picked out bits on the acoustic. I like how there's a little acoustic picking out some bits around the electric lead. All adds up to make this an eerie classic. And I definitely heard this one before. I wouldn't have known who it was by or why, but I've definitely heard it. And the horn section bit is, that's the bit which says, well, this isn't the Shadows. The Shadows wouldn't have that weird. It goes major. It goes into a major chord, doesn't it? And then it goes into this.
It does. It's in 4-4 in D minor, and also sort of moves around F major as well. But it does at one point then move to D major, and that's quite a sort of shocking moment. Yeah. That's always a weird key change where you don't move to like a relative major. You sort of just go, well, I'm just changing to a major key now.
Yeah, and I'm also heralding in a strange fanfare section, which is then going to bring in a drum solo. It's bonkers. I love it for it. It's great. So I've given it 57 for music, this one.
Cool.
I like it. Production. So it's a bit, reminds me a bit like Johnny Remember Me, in that I suspect I'm going to say that, you know, I don't think the production is obviously as good as the ones we've been listening to before, but you're going to tell me it was recorded by some kind of pioneer using a shoebox in a sewer or something.
No, I'm not. As I say, it was recorded by Tony Meehan at Decca.
Right.
So you know, he was working there. He was able to sort of oversee the session. I think the interesting thing about this is that it is so distinctly not Abbey Road, and it is, you know, there's all these things. It's not as extreme as Joe Meek recordings, but it's clearly a different studio with a different sound, and that's why people have favourites from these different record companies and the different studios they use. So,
yeah. I mean, if this had the clarity of the Shadows recordings, while retaining the spooky vocals and the mad horn bit, it could have been possibly very outstanding, like really, really good. As it is, I do love the drums and guitar. The bass is lost quite a lot of the time, which is a shame, because when you do hear it, it sounds like a really nice, rounded bass sound. But it's not, it's muddy to kind of catch it. The backing vocals, like I said, are purposefully quiet, but they're very, very, very subtle. And I wonder if they could have probably suffered a little bit more volume, because they're sometimes almost inaudible. But the horn section, which I really like, just also gets a bit messy in the mix and a bit too much. And the reason is, I think one of the guitars, maybe even the lead guitar, starts playing full chords, but with all the reverb still on, and that starts to swamp that bit a little bit. Mm. It starts to take it over and make it a bit soupy. It's so close, but I think it could have been, I think it could have been a better production. It's not just a different production, I just don't think it's quite as good. But it is different in the choice of things, but I think it could have been handled slightly better, but I still like it. So I'm giving it 48 for production.
Yeah, it's a funny one, really, because if you read into Jet Harris and Tony Meehan working together, obviously this was a big smash hit, and it basically propelled them to being the most in-demand performers in the country at the time.
Yeah.
They were getting like £1,000 a week. But Jet Harris was clearly not well. And I don't know much about his backstory, but, you know, it's like it took two or three days to record Diamonds, says Tony Meehan. Jet was ill and had difficulty learning it. And he was, by February of 1963, I think it was, he was being checked into like a Harley Street nursing home, suffering from nervous exhaustion.
Right.
So it's a strange thing that perhaps they weren't cut out for the stardom as frontmen necessarily, but you know what the demands on people are at the time, the touring, the appearances, and the amount of stuff you have to do. So it's just interesting that perhaps that mate perhaps came into the studio a little bit as well.
Oh, okay. Well, as I say, 48 for production and 53 overall, because there's no lyrics, once again, saving us a bit of time. So at least we've got that. No, I like that. It's a good one. So next then, and finally for this episode, Paul, finally someone who isn't either Cliff Richard or the Shadows
or related to them
directly, we have Frank Ifield, The Wayward Wind.
Oh, I met a girl in a border town. I vowed we'd never part. Though I tried my best to settle down, she's now alone with a broken heart. And the wayward wind is a restless wind.
The Wayward Wind, Paul.
No, I made sure I did my little burps before I started recording.
Ah, I wondered which way you were going to go with that.
Yeah, I thought I'd go the nicer way. Yeah, The Wayward Wind by Frank Ifield, number one on the 21st of February 1963 for 3 weeks.
Okay.
So that takes us through to sort of mid-March. Guess what? It's Norrie Paramore again in Columbia.
He's doing all right, isn't he?
He does all right. Well, he's the producer at this point.
Yeah.
And like, we're looking forward to certain things happening with the sort of people we see in the charts, we'll start seeing different names appearing more often in the production stakes as well.
Hmm.
So this is a cover written by Stanley Linofsky and Herb Newman. Someone called Gogi Grant had a hit in America with it in a number one in 1956. And there have been lots of cover versions. And a version by Tex Ritter had been number eight in the UK in 1956.
Mm-hmm.
So Gogi Grant's version knocked Heartbreak Hotel off the number one spot. So that tells you sort of how popular it was back then. And do you know what? Do you know when we do these recordings and we sort of do all our pre-listening and stuff like that, and then you spend the next few days with one of these songs stuck in your head?
Yes. Yeah. And normally one that I've like completely slagged off.
Usually.
That's the one I can't get out of my head.
My one this week has been The Wayward Wind, because I really quite like it again. They've dialed down, the big dial that says Yodel in the studio has been turned down again.
Yeah.
The B-side is a song called I'm Smiling Now, but there's not much to say about that really. It's just a nice little song. But yeah, it's sort of country pop cover from Frank Ifield with a harmonica again, which has been wrecking my brain.
I saw your tweet.
So we famously found, or we know that famously Harry Pitch played the harmonica in I Remember You.
Yes, we famously did.
Yes, so we famously did. But I don't know who played the harmonica on this one, and it's really annoying because it sounds a little bit like it probably influenced I Should Have Known Better.
Yeah.
The way it plays.
That's what it was. I knew, yeah.
Yeah. But so I don't know who recorded it. It's entirely possible it was Harry Pitch, but I couldn't find any evidence to that. In fact, I can't find any evidence of who it was at all. So it could have been Arthur Tolcher, who recorded some stuff with Frank Ifield, but probably did more stuff on stage with him. He's a guy who keeps turning up in Morecambe and Wise to play the harmonica. Not now, Arthur.
Right.
And it's possibly even, and this information comes via Andrew Hickey of the 500 Songs podcast, via our friend Tyler from the Goon Show podcast, who got in on this, trying to figure this out. It's possibly even Delbert McClinton, who played on Hey Baby by Bruce Channel,
right,
who was in the UK at the time and did some recordings in the UK. But I just can't find out, and it's really annoying me for something that doesn't matter at all.
Okay, well, we'll leave that one to maybe the music squirrels out there will come up with some fact nuts for us. But so much is going on in this one. I mean, we have the strings. The main thing with this is that it's being the wind, isn't it? So we have the strings.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's a bit of everything. It's a composite. So the strings are being the kind of little trills of the wind. They're doing the trills, aren't they?
I just did that.
Along with the mouth organ, which is quite literally windy, but I think it's cold, the in-out. Obviously, that's the kind of way the mouth organ's played, but it's, like you're saying, it's doing a very... I think it's it. I think that's meant to be part of the wind with the way it's being played. It's doing a lot of breathing in and out all one after the other to make it kind of that push and pull of the wind. And then you have the backing vocals doing the kind of like om style thing. You know, they go om.
Not ommers.
No, they're missing out the ers. But they're doing they're kind of going hum. It's more like a hum really, it's not rather than an om. But it's like that creates a kind of breezy backdrop. And I think the whole point of that is those three things together are meant to be the whole atmosphere, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, it's a good sound picture.
Yeah, it's a good sound picture. And it's not often we get actual music trying to sound like the weather it is describing. It does happen. And it'd be an interesting exercise to try and think of the songs where the music is being this weather sound, you know, the sound of rain and the sound of storms or whatever. It makes me think of school music lessons where we'd get given a big box of random percussion instruments and be told that you're going to be sunshine and you're going to be rain, you know.
And yes, at the end of the lesson, I was just thinking that.
Yeah, it's not often you get to do that because you get taught to do kind of graphical and representation of things and stuff in music lessons, but you never, it doesn't really actually come through that way. Apart from when I played, you know, and composed a piece with the BBC Philharmonic and played that when I was at school, which is a different story about the planets. It's done to great effect. He walks the novelty line very closely, does old Frank. He doesn't do much yodeling in this, like you say. He does get to hit a high note. He does kind of sneak one in a little bit, doesn't he?
Oh, made him a slave.
Slave. a couple of points he gets to do that, to use that ability he's got to jump to his falsetto, basically, just instantly and strongly. I like it. It's a little daft, but it's been nicely arranged and constructed to encapsulate the theme and make it sound like he's really is singing against the backdrop of a windy alley or something.
Alley? It wasn't she in Cheers? no, it's like a. Well, the lyrics tell you. It's basically it's prospectors. It's open country. It's being near the railroad. It's the wind blowing across the plains
as he wanders through his wayward life. Again, we have a key change here, don't we? We do have a key
change. That was the key change I mentioned. So literally it goes from an E flat up to an E major. But it does it while it's going dong, 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 dong. And it's just much more effective, even though it's exactly the same trick as in that first Cliff song. It's more effective in this one.
They do it into a big breakdown verse, though, here, don't they? The key change, like you say, signals in a big, I say big, but it's a verse where everything kind of, the rhythm section drops out and leaves just the kind of windy stuff before it all comes back again. And we get a nice fade out where it introduces a minor chord just for a little bit and just gives it
I haven't done an illustration for ages, but I've written down about that because one of my favourite things. So that'll do, near enough for jazz.
Yeah.
So you tend to have with these things, if you were in E, as it is towards the end of the song, you'd be having E. A major, B, E. But one of my favourite things is where you go from like that first chord to the next chord, but you do it as a minor. So in this one, it's...
Yeah.
Oh, love it. It's great.
Yeah, it's nice. And it just keeps up the eeriness right to the last minute, right to the fade out, you know. It's great. I've given it 48 for music. I think it's a bit novelty, but it's fun.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's my favourite one of his, but I've liked all of his Frank Highfield stuff. I'm quite.
I know he's doing all right, isn't he?
Yeah, he's he feels, to me, he feels more kind of like wholesome than Cliff in the sense that he's not trying to be. He's just doing music that sounds all right. You know, it's not like trying to be like anything. It's just music that's accessible and okay. You know, like good. For the sake of sounding nice without having to be an image orientated thing. However, I don't know. I don't really know what his image was. So, yeah, we get to the lyrics then. So, like you say, this is a cover.
We haven't done production yet, Gary.
Have I missed production altogether?
Yeah.
I'll get back to production then. A lot of the reasons I like the music are wound up with the production, like we've said, about the creation of the wind ambience. I know it's instruments that are doing that. But I think that combination of the voices, the instruments, playing unorthodox kind of parts to create that soundscape would have needed a deft touch at the console, I would have thought. Who produced this one again?
Norrie McParamore,
yeah. Yes.
Norrie McParamore.
And I think they pulled that off and it sounds good.
It does, yeah. I don't think there's much to say about it other than it's exactly like a bit like the last one. It's Frank is right in the middle, nice and clear. They've panned off the various bits and bobs.
Mm-hmm.
Like drums off one side, harmonica and strings off the other side type thing. So his voice has got its place, but it all sits together well, as usual.
I like the fade out, especially when it's a song like this with a wandering vibe. I think the fade out a production choice that works to kind of go, oh, now the song's just kind of wisping away. Bye, oh, the wind, bye. So I've given it 56 for production. I'll talk about the lyrics. And I think the lyrics have been gender flipped from the original, have they not? I was looking for the lyrics on the internet, and even the ones that were marked as Frank Ifield had it about he was a restless boy and I was left waiting. And this is I was the restless boy and she was left waiting.
Yeah, yeah. Like I say, Gogi Grant had the first hit and obviously that's a female singer.
Yes, so they've gender flipped that, but it works just the same. Where's it? So this time it's the windy man himself talking or singing. I like the line, I was born the next of kin to a restless wind.
Yeah.
It's good. The next of kin to a restless wind is great. The only problem is that the whole song makes me think about trumping and jokes about trumping or if that's not something you use in your vernacular, farting, passing wind, breaking wind. Yeah. Whatever words you use.
Bronx cheer. Yeah. As it used to say on whoopee cushions.
It's the wayward wind. I mean, the amount of jokes.
It's this a bit was a like
contemporary hit in my
eating,
house.
Eating beans in Blazing Saddles.
Yes. It's it must have been made a million times with this song. There must have been lots of jokes about the wayward wind. Because it sounds so cool in one way. They call me the wayward wind. And then you think, in another way, it really doesn't. I still quite like it, but I've given it 45 for lyrics.
Yeah, okay.
Because of the song, 50 overall.
Well, I will mention, and this is illustrated in Disc magazine on the 16th of February 1963, Wayward Wind hits the top and, 3 in a row, Frank Ifield has made Disc history. Ifield has made Disc history. He has become the only British, Australian, singer ever to get his first 3 hits into the number one slot, beating even the sensational starts of Cliff Richard and Adam Faith.
Oh, see, so he's 3 for 3 at this point.
Yeah, basically.
He's come straight out with hits and right.
They're sort of, the way they're bracketing out sort of his releases in this particular time. But yeah, he's making chart history.
Let's hope nothing comes along to upset the apple cart and change the tastes
as
of everybody.
Keep saying. Yeah.
Poor Frank. I like Frank. I don't know if he might carry on, you know. I'm very interested to see.
He's still with us.
Yeah. Oh, hello, Frank. Is he with you now?
If he was, I'd have asked him out at the harmonica.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, if he's still with us.
Is Frank in the room with you now?
I'm over here. Though, if he's still with us, maybe we can get a message to him somehow. If anyone listening knows a way to contact Frank Ifield and ask him who played harmonica on the Wayward Winds to put Paul's mind at rest, please, let's make this thing happen. And send us an iMac. Okay, so that's that's it for the end of the episode, isn't it, I think?
That's the first few for 1963 out of the way. Sorry, so it was so Cliff Richardy.
It was, I know. Well, you know, it's just building us up for what's to come. And out of the ones we've done this week, only one's made it into the top 20. So the 4 that didn't make it into the top 20 in reverse order are Cliff Richard and the Shadows the next time with at number 43, Cliff Richard and the Shadows Bachelor Boy at number 40, the Shadows Dance On at number 38. Narrowly missing out is Frank Ifield and the Wayward Wind at number 24.
Oh.
Okay. So let's go through the top 20 and see where everyone else is. Ready?
Yes.
At number 20, Helen Shapiro, Walking Back to Happiness. At number 19, Jet Harris and Tony Meehan, Diamonds. At number 18, Poetry in Motion, Johnny Tillotson. At number 17, Are You Lonesome Tonight, Elvis Presley. At number 16, Return to Sender, Elvis Presley. At number 15, The Highwayman, Michael. At number 14, Bee Bumble and the Stingers, Nut Rocker. At number 13, It's Now or Never, Elvis Presley. At number 12, Elvis Presley, Surrender. At number 11, The Everly Brothers, Walk Right Back. At number 10, Ray Charles, I Can't Stop Loving You. At number 9, The Tornadoes, Telstar. At number 8, Elvis Presley, Marie's the Name, His Latest Flame. At number 7, Wonderful Land, The Shadows. At number 6, The Everly Brothers, Kathy's Clown. At number 5, Roy Orbison, Only the Lonely. At number 4, Johnny Kidd and the Pirates, Shaking All Over. At number 3, Moon River, Danny Williams. At number 2, The Shadows, Apache. And at number 1, Del Shannon, Runaway.
There we have it.
There we have it. I wonder how this will get... I've got to stop just saying, I wonder what's going to...
Yeah.
I wonder how the Beatles are going to...
Because easily found outable.
Yeah.
Foundable out? No, it's not right either way.
It's easily found out about what's coming up, but I do wonder, because we've got to also answer the question next week, what do we do? What do I do? Do I score again? I think I'll score again.
I think you're going to have to score again, because you have now set yourself up with
however
many numbers of framework against which to put the Beatles stuff.
I was marking the Beatles against themselves last time. So I kind of had in my head the lower end songs for me and what I thought was going to be the top end songs. I'm thinking I need to kind of work within them parameters. I wasn't marking them against all music. So yes, I will score them again. And
good.
And we'll talk about them again. Keep it easy. Make it easy.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll talk about them against what we've been hearing, which is obviously the whole point. So, yeah, thanks for listening, and we will see you in the very exciting next week.
The very exciting next week. Brilliant.
Bye-bye.
Wayward Wind!